from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, we hear from Billy Porter, star of the musical Kinky Boots and the FX series Pose. His new memoir is about growing up black and gay in a church community that insisted he was damned and with a stepfather who sexually abused him. His singing voice was his salvation, but it was still hard for him to fit in on Broadway and in the music industry. Also, we talk with British actress and singer Cynthia Erivo. She was nominated for an Oscar for her performance as Harriet Tubman in the film Harriet and for the film's closing credits song, which she co-wrote and sang. She played Aretha Franklin in the miniseries Genius Aretha and won a Tony for her starring role in the Broadway revival of The Color Purple. She's a remarkable singer and has a new solo album. My guest, Billy Porter, won an Emmy in 2019 for his starring role in the FX series Pose, set in the gay and trans underground ballroom scene of the late 80s and early 90s, the culture that inspired Madonna's hit 1990 record Vogue. Porter's character, known as Pray Tell, was the ball MC and provided the commentary for ball competitions involving dancing, lip-syncing, and costumes. The balls are celebratory, but as the series progressed and time elapsed, the AIDS epidemic kept getting worse, and a growing number of people in the community were dying. After losing dear friends, Pray Tell was diagnosed with AIDS. Billy Porter was adjacent to the ballroom scene, and his new memoir, Unprotected, shows some of the parallels between his life and Pray Tell's. The book also describes the obstacles he faced growing up poor in Pittsburgh, with a mother who had a degenerative neurological disorder, a stepfather who sexually abused him, and schoolmates who brutally bullied him. He found many creative ways to circumvent these obstacles and managed to get admitted to a performing arts high school, study theater at Carnegie Mellon University, and get parts in Broadway shows. In 2013, he won a Tony and Grammy for his starring role in the Broadway musical Kinky Boots. But it's always been hard. Roles were scarce because he was black, or because his voice was too high, or he was too gay. He was even told he was too flamboyant for characters that were described as flamboyant. Now he kind of embraces flamboyant and is famous for his red carpet appearances in clothes that are both elegant and outrageous at the same time. The most famous is his tuxedo gown, a tuxedo on top and a hoop-skirted gown on bottom. Let's start with a scene from the first season of Pose. When Pray Tell MCs balls, he's colorful in his praise and in his put-downs. Here he is commenting on a dance performance by Candy, a trans woman who Pray Tell has always been critical of. Candy is played by Angelica Ross.
The category is called lofting. It is a dance category for actual dancers. We've been down this road before. You are not a dancer, you are not a voguer, and quite frankly, I'm concerned about your health. Breakdancing might burst that silicone, and you don't want to go back to that flat ass you used to have now, do you?
Why are you always reading me the riot act, Pray Tell? You go out of your way to put me down.
I don't have to put you down when you're always in the bottom.
Billy Porter, welcome to Fresh Air. You are so great in that role.
Thank you.
And your new book is so good. Did you pattern your version of an MC on anybody you saw MC? I know you were told to pattern it after the MC in a documentary about the ball culture called Paris is Burning, but did you draw on your own experiences too?
Well, I am a person who grew up in a Pentecostal church. You know, I was labeled Little Preacher Man when I was like 5 or 6. I preached my first sermon when I was my first and last sermon when I was around 10 or 11. You know, so to sort of have those kind of oratory skills is something that I've always had. I also went into the role knowing that I needed to ground the character of Pray Tell in something that felt important, something that felt classic. And I was like, you know, this should feel Shakespearean. It should feel like the most important thing on the planet because to these people it is. And so as I began to work on the character, I really leaned into this grand and grounded classical largesse, if you will, because I've always found that in the theater, those are the performances that move me the most, you know, and we in the theater have a unique ability to be huge and real simultaneously. And I knew that Pray Tell needed to be that.
My impression is, you know, he delivers a lot of very cutting put downs to people whose performances don't measure up, in his opinion. My impression reading your book is that you are pretty skilled at that yourself and use it as needed to maintain your demand for respect.
That's a good way of putting it. But let me be clear.
Yes.
I am not Pray Tell at all. And it is always my last resort. I have a tongue. I can take up for myself. Don't mistake my kindness for weakness. But I am always leading with kindness and compassion first.
When you were young, and getting bullied, was your tongue helpful?
No, because my tongue was the thing that made people mad. My tongue made people madder because I was also extremely intelligent. So, like, I could make somebody feel like a dummy. And that's not what you want your bully to feel like.
Well, you also say in the book that you had such, like, good, like, enunciation, so clear. And
yes.
That people found that, like...
Well, people in the hood found that to be too white. People thought I was trying to be white from the hood. And I was like, I'm not. This is just the way I talk. I don't know what else to say. I came out talking in complete sentences, and I would prefer to continue to do so. And I don't necessarily ascribe to, you know, what we called it at that time was Ebonics. You know, what we call it today, I don't know what we call it today. In the 70s, it was called jive. You know, I just talk like a regular person as far as I'm concerned.
So when you were growing up, you used to go to the library and check out cast recordings. And the librarian there said, here's the only cast recording you're going to need this week. It's Sunday in the Park with George. And that had a huge impact on you. What was it about Sunday in the Park with George that spoke to you?
You know, even at that age, I understood the healing power of art. Sunday in the Park with George is about that. It's about getting to the truth of yourself as a human being through your art. I don't know. It was so deep. I was 14 years old. I just got it.
Let's stick with Sondheim for a moment. You auditioned for a revival of Into the Woods, which is the Sondheim James Lapine musical based on fairy tales. And you auditioned for The Baker. You auditioned for James Lapine, who wrote the book for Into the Woods and was directing this revival. You auditioned for The Baker, and he thought you weren't quite right for it, but you really wanted to play the witch.
Mm-hmm. And he brought it up.
He brought it up. Okay, so what did he say, and what was your reaction?
Well, you know, I went in for The Baker, and I took all my fabulous out. Because I couldn't get people to take me seriously as an actor. And my voice is very specific. And so early on in auditions, I would rearrange things, change keys, make it so that I was presenting myself in the greatest way that I possibly could. Well, that was pigeonholing me. And so I understood that if I wanted anybody to take me seriously as an actor, I was going to have to go in and take all the fabulous out. And The Baker is not fabulous. And so I went in, and The Baker also, for those of you who are musicians listening, The Baker is way too low for me. Like, I am a high tenor, almost an alto with extension. At this time, I was an alto. Like, my voice was really high. So I finished singing No More, and James Lapine, who had known me because I'd worked with him on Faust, this Randy Newman musical called Faust, a few years prior, a workshop of it. So he knew me, and he knew my talent, and he knew my fabulous. And he said, oh, that was beautifully acted, Billy. That's all I needed to hear. And I went to get my stuff, and I was getting ready to go. And he's like, well, where are you going? Because I didn't think for one second that anybody was going to cast a black person in a Sondheim musical, because we were still there at that point. The only black person that had really been cast in a Sondheim musical at that point was Mrs. Huxtable replacing Bernadette Peters. And that's because she brings in ticket sales. Not, you know, there was no, like, regular black person. I think Terry Burrell was a stepsister in Into the Woods as a replacement. I mean, like, that's how much I know about it, because that's how I still haven't been cast in a Sondheim show. And he's one of my favorites. So anyway, you know, so then he said, well, you know, you have a little bit too much pizzazz for the Baker, you know, but I've been thinking about the possibility of, like, maybe playing with the gender of the witch. And I said, please don't play with my emotions. Because, like, that is my biggest dream. And so he said, great, well, you know, go and take the material and come back in a couple of days and let's see what you do with it. And I said, I don't need to take the material away. I can do it now. And he said, what? I said, I can sing it now. I just need a few minutes to go over the sides for the script, but I can sing it now. Because, you know, I had Last Midnight. I mean, you know, that was committed to memory and Bernadette's key. So, you know, I went outside for 10 minutes, read over the script, came back in and sang Last Midnight, and they gagged.
They gagged?
Gagged. That's Quinglish for they had an amazing response.
So, okay, so, but then 9/11 happened, and then you never heard from them again. So you never got to do it. You did, I will add, end up doing an all-black production of Sondheim songs. I don't know if it was a review or...
It was a review of Sondheim's music.
But what I want to do here is play your recording of The Last Midnight, which is featured on your album At the Corner of Broadway and Soul. And I really like this version of it, Billy. So let's hear it. So this is my guest, Billy Porter, singing The Last Midnight from the Sondheim musical Into the Woods.
It's the last midnight. It's the last wish. It's the last midnight. Soon it will be boom, squish. Told a little lie, stole a little gold, broke a little vow. Did you? Had to get your prince, had to get your cow. Have to get your wish, doesn't matter how. Anyway, it doesn't matter now. It's the last midnight, it's the boom splat. Nothing but a vast midnight. Everybody smashed flat. Nothing we can do. Not exactly true. We could always give her the boy. No, 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 no. Of course, what really matters is the blame. Somebody to blame. Fine, if that's the thing you enjoy, placing the blame. If that's the aim, give me the blame. Just give me the boy.
That was my guest, Billy Porter, singing Sondheim's The Last Midnight from the show Into the Woods. And it's featured on his album At the Corner of Broadway and Soul. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break. And we'll hear from Cynthia Erivo. She played Harriet Tubman in the film Harriet, and Aretha Franklin in Genius Aretha. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Let's get back to my interview with Billy Porter. He won an Emmy for his starring role in the FX series Pose, about the underground queer ballroom culture of the late 80s and early 90s. He played the ball MC known as Pray Tell. Porter won a Tony for his starring role as the drag queen Lola in the Broadway musical Kinky Boots, and a Grammy for the cast recording. He has a new memoir, which is called Unprotected. Let's talk a little about your book. There's a lot of trauma in the book. I'm starting with the Pentecostal church. You know, as we talked about, we were called like little preacher.
Little preacher man, they called me, yeah. When I was young.
And your mother was very religious, still is. And church was, in a way, the place where you were damned because they thought you were too effeminate and leaning toward gay, which would be like big sin in your church, the Pentecostal.
An abomination.
Church. Abomination, yes. But it's also the place where people recognized you had a gift. You have the gift of speaking. You had the gift of singing, and what a gift it is. So that, I'm sure, was very confusing for you. How much did you believe that you were going to be damned?
When it's the only thing you know, it's the only thing that you can believe. It was in the sixth grade when I was introduced to theater and bust, you know, in the second sort of wave of desegregation, that I was introduced to another world. And that was sort of what cracked open a space for me to dream beyond my circumstance.
When you were diagnosed with HIV a few years ago, was the fear still with you? Because people were saying, like, you know, AIDS is God's curse for homosexuality. And you heard that a lot because you were at a lot of ACT UP protests. And there were always protesters of the protesters.
And a lot of churches.
Yeah, yes, exactly. In Pose, your character is diagnosed with AIDS. And if you're still in the middle of watching Pose, as you're listening now, put your hands over your ears as I say this next sentence. Okay, that's sufficient time for hands over ears. Your character at the end of the series dies of AIDS. What was it like for you knowing that you had HIV and that it was under control? You were taking the medicines, they were doing their job, and you were playing somebody who was dying. You say in your book, your body doesn't know the difference between performing something and actually living through something. So what was it like for you to have to live your character's experience dying of AIDS?
You know, I have to say the first two seasons, I was so excited that somebody was finally taking me seriously as an actor that I didn't even realize I was being triggered. You know, I was so excited that I was able to play a character where I could use the work to sort of try to heal my own pain, my own shame as it related to my own HIV status. And the last day when I went in to, or the day I went in to shoot the my death scene, I said to the whole cast and crew, this is the death of Pray Tell, but the rebirth of Billy. And that has been a very powerful, powerful thing that has come out of the show.
What did you mean that it was your rebirth?
Because I was getting ready to tell the world that I was HIV positive and I was getting ready to get myself free. And I knew that that was happening. I set myself free, honey. No more secrets.
You kept that secret for years because you were diagnosed in 07.
Yeah, 14 years.
Yeah. What was it like to keep that secret for so long? And, why did you feel you needed to keep it secret?
Shame. You know, shame is a silencer. Shame is a killer. Shame is a murderer. And, you know, I had nothing but shame in my entire life. And so, you know, it was actively working through the shame to get to the other side of that, which is truth and healing and authenticity.
Were there also practical reasons for keeping it secret, like fear that no one would take a chance on you fearing that you'd be sick, that you couldn't get insurance if you were in a movie?
It was 2007, and, you know, I didn't know, and I wasn't working, and I was on the precipice of obscurity, so I wasn't trying to, like, you know, throw another wrench into just another reason for somebody not to hire me. And I also, you know, my mom went through so much when I came out as queer and wouldn't acquiesce to the church's demands for my straightness. And she went through a lot.
Billy Porter, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for your new book. And thank you for doing this interview. It's been just a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Billy Porter's new memoir is called Unprotected. My next guest is another award-winning actor and singer, Cynthia Erivo. In 2016, after coming to the U.S. from England, she won a Tony and Drama Desk Award for her starring role in the Broadway revival of the musical The Color Purple. For her starring role as Harriet Tubman in the film Harriet, she was nominated for an Oscar and was also nominated for the closing credits song Stand Up, which she co-wrote and sang. The song won an award from the Society of Composers and Lyricists. Erivo played Aretha Franklin in this year's TV miniseries, Genius Aretha, which you can still watch on Hulu. She didn't get to sing in the HBO series The Outsider, adapted from a Stephen King story, but she was great in that too. Now she sings in the character of herself on her debut album, Chapter 1, Verse 1, featuring songs she co-wrote. Erivo grew up in South London, where her parents emigrated from Nigeria. I wanted to know what it was like to play Aretha and to try to sing like her. Before we hear what she had to say, let's hear Erivo sing in a scene from the miniseries Genius Aretha. This is set during her first recording session for Atlantic Records in 1967. Aretha is at the piano singing I Never Loved a Man. Cynthia Erivo from the miniseries Genius Aretha. Cynthia Erivo, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
It is such a pleasure to have you on the show. I know you've said that when you were listening to Aretha before playing her, that one of the things you were listening for is where did she breathe?
Oh, yeah.
Why was that important?
Because the breath, I think, tells you everything about what the person is trying to say. You know, if you look at a sentence, where the comma goes tells you what the sentence means. If I say, today I've been feeling really, really bad, but, and now I say, today I've been feeling really bad, but I'll be all right. Well, now I feel ill, and one is emotionally, I feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And so when she would breathe in different places, and it would change the sentence structure, it would change the meaning of the song. Another person might sing it a completely different way.
Can you sing us an example of what you mean?
I use this song often to explain it because it's, one, it's a beautiful song, and two, I had to really, really dig in and learn it. And three, it just is a wonderful example of how the breath work changes. It's called Never Grow Old. I had to learn it for the Amazing Grace episode. And it goes like this. The sentence is, I have heard of a land on a faraway strand. That's the sentence. The normal way to sing it is, I have heard of a land on a faraway strand. Right?
Mm-hmm.
She sings, I have heard of a land on far away strand.
Get the impression that it's more far away.
Exactly.
The way you sang it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, it was beautiful both ways. You met her twice, backstage at The Color Purple and at the Kennedy Center. Did you feel like you were able to have a meaningful conversation with her? I think sometimes, like when you meet somebody who's so important to you, you just don't know what to say.
I think I was that. I didn't really know what to say, but I was also sort of disarmed by how funny she was. She was so, like, jovial. She joked that when I first met her, she sang the last sentence of my big song back at me. And so I almost fell over because Aretha Franklin is singing and I'm here back at me. And I didn't know what to do. I think I just laughed. I was just like, oh my God. Hi.
Did she sing it like you, or did she sing it like her?
I think she sang it like her singing it like me.
Right.
You know what I mean? So she had memorized how I had sang it, like the phrasing, and sang that sentence, but she sounds like her. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to forget this because it meant that she remembered it and that it stuck with her. And I remember her saying, well, you can sing. Zing. I was like, okay, oh my God, this is nuts. I don't know if I needed anything more meaningful than that, to be honest, because if the Queen of Soul can remember you as the person who can sing, well, wonderful.
She was brought up in the church, and she was brought up singing gospel in the church on tours through the South and in her father's church. And so when she started singing R&B, it was so church influenced. And I'm wondering about if you grew up churched at all in England, and if so, what the music was like.
I did grow up in church. But different, because I'm Roman Catholic is what I was raised on. But I was a bit of a rebel. So when I was in church, it was a lot of like Christian hymns. And I wanted more because I was listening to gospel music and I was learning about gospel singers and I was learning about that sound. And I wanted to hear it in my own church. So one of the churches, we moved to East London from South London, and that church had a choir. So I remember they asked if I could join the choir, and so I did. And then somehow I managed to end up being like one of the conductors of the choir. And I would just like sneak gospel songs in from time to time. And just have them like sing a couple gospel songs. Consequently, I got into trouble for it, and they were like, "You can't sing those songs in here anymore." And I never understood why, because I felt like all music that was for the same reason was equal and was meaningful.
Was the objection to the gospel music the lyrics of the song or the style of singing?
I think it's the style of singing. I think the style of singing was where the objection came. There's a particularly straight-laced way of praising that's correct for the Catholic Church. There's a specific way that you should do it, and there's a specific thing that you can sing. There are specific songs, and anything outside of the lines is too far.
Was this a predominantly white congregation?
Very much so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My guest is Cynthia Erivo. She has a new album called Chapter 1, Verse 1, and a new children's book called Remember to Dream, Eboré. We'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. 500,000 businesses connect using Zoom, a single platform for phone, chat, workspaces, events, apps, and video. Zoom enables real-time collaboration for teams around the globe. Zoom's secure and reliable platform is easy to manage, use, and customize for large enterprises, small businesses, and individuals alike. Zoom, how the world connects.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hunter Douglas. Who doesn't love to live well in perfect comfort and style? Hunter Douglas can help you do just that with their innovative window shade designs and control systems so advanced they can be scheduled to automatically adjust to their optimal position throughout the day. Live beautifully with Hunter Douglas. Visit hunterdouglas.com/fresh today to take advantage of the Season of Style rebate savings event. Offer expires December 6th, 2021.
Let's get back to my interview with Cynthia Erivo. She won a Tony for her starring role in the Broadway revival of The Color Purple. She was nominated for an Oscar for her performance as Harriet Tubman in the film Harriet, and was also nominated for the closing song Stand Up, which she co-wrote and sang. She was one of the stars of the HBO adaptation of the Stephen King novel The Outsider. She just released her debut album, Chapter 1, Verse 1, and she's written a new children's book called Remember to Dream, Eboré. Oh, and I didn't mention that she played Aretha Franklin in the TV miniseries Genius Aretha, which is streaming on Hulu. Your parents separated, I think, when you were pretty young. And by the time you were 16, your father told you and your sister that he was done.
Well, he told me. He told me.
Oh, it was just you?
Just me. He told me that he was out of our lives. And I sort of had to relay the message to everyone, yeah.
What was your reaction? Could you see that coming?
I didn't see it coming, although in hindsight, I probably should have seen it coming, but I didn't see it coming because, you know, what 16-year-old would. At the time, I was heartbroken because it was in public when it happened as well. So it was just like not fun. But yeah, it was deeply disappointing, deeply heartbreaking. And I think I felt bad for having to have to bring that information back to my house, to my mum and my sister. And I remember it was in the middle of a school day, so I still had to go through school. That was not fun.
Did he give you an explanation?
No, not really. No. No, I think he just said, I think he was finished being a dad.
Have you spoken to him since?
No.
Well,
I actually tell a lie. I bumped into him randomly at a cousin's wedding. We had an awkward hello, and that's it. When I was 25.
You went to RADA, which is the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in England. Very famous school. You didn't know it existed when you were invited to apply for it.
I did not.
Was it revelatory once you got there to study acting in such a formal and probably traditional way?
Yeah, because I didn't know that that was even a possibility. When I was going through primary school or secondary school, no one was like, you can go to drama school. No one gave me that option. So the whole thing was revelatory. Like the first year was both discovery and a struggle and a half, because I just like, what am I doing here? And there's so many things I don't really understand. Is what was my strong suit was that I was a little bit different to most people, that I was one of the kids that was good at singing. And we had a particularly musical year, so there were a couple of other kids who could sing too. And actually being able to sing was really useful. And when I started to embrace that, I sort of could see where the opportunities were. Some people were really wonderful at the classics and at Jacobi's, and, you know, those kids that came from Eton who had read those things were brilliant at those things. But I wasn't that. My raw talent came from understanding music. So when we started talking about Sondheim and learning those songs, for me, I was in heaven. And when we started reading Seven Guitars by August Wilson, I recognized myself in those people because, well, it was a black writer writing about black people, and I could see myself in them. And those are plays I had read, and there's a playwright I had heard of. And when you're passionate about acting, Shakespeare was where we all sort of like joined hands because, well, we all knew Shakespeare, but now I could have a sort of a real grasp on the scope at which he wrote.
You know, when you were talking about Aretha, you talked about the importance of where you breathe and how it can even change the meaning of a phrase. So when you were learning Sondheim songs, I think breath is really especially important in those songs in terms of the meaning, but in some of the songs just in terms of having an opportunity to breathe. Because some of the songs, there isn't a lot of opportunity. And those songs are really rangy, you know, so your breath support would be really important. Is there a song you especially loved when you started singing Sondheim?
I loved Being Alive, and I loved The Miller's Son. Have you ever heard The Miller's Son?
I have. I've seen you sing it on YouTube. So if anybody wants to see it, it's there.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite songs. And that is one of those songs where you're like, if you don't breathe in the right place, you won't make it to the end of the sentence.
Can you give us an example of what you mean?
Oh my God, I don't even know if I can remember the lyrics. I haven't done it for such a long time. Is it, it's a wink and a wiggle and a giggle and a grass and I'll trip the light fandango. A pinch and a diddle in the middle of a passers-by. It's a very short road from the pinch and the punch to the paunch and the pouch and the pension. It's a very short road to the 10,000th lunch and the paunch and the pouch and the sigh. In the meanwhile, there are mouths to be kissed before mouths to be fed and a lot in between in the meanwhile. And a girl has to celebrate what passes by or I shall marry the miller's son.
Yeah, thank you. How did you figure out where to breathe? Did you get advice on that? Did it seem natural?
I got advice. I had a really lovely teacher at RADA. It was Philip. He was just, he was wonderful, actually. I will say that my singing teacher at RADA, we're all sort of assigned a singing teacher. Most of us, because we've never sung before, so we can learn about what that is and learn how to connect the singing voice and the singing breath with the speaking voice and the speaking breath. So we don't differentiate the two so far apart that we're afraid of one of them, because they're sort of one and the same. And I think that because I was already in tune with my singing voice, what Philip did with me was encourage me to try new things, try more. So he would have me singing arias from Otello.
And were you comfortable singing in an operatic style, or did it not matter which style you sang in as long as you did the singing?
I was comfortable. Classical music was sort of a love of mine. And then when I went to drama school, my voice was already sort of ready to try that. And it's the same. Whilst I was doing The Color Purple, my singing teacher, Joan Lader, who's wonderful, she would give me classical music or opera to sing, because she said that the best way to allow my voice to be open enough to sing what I was singing on stage was to just try something that was totally opposite to it. So you weren't taxing your voice the same way the entire time. You were just sort of opening it up and exercising it, but not stressing it.
Can you give us an example of how you learned to open up your voice?
I'll do one of the first things I did at secondary school, actually, because we'd always do sort of like the end of year like choral show. And this one year we decided to do Rutter Requiem, the Rutter Requiem by John Rutter. And I was asked to sing there's a there's a version of Pia Jesu for the Gianrotto Requiem, and it's very special. Who knows if I can still do these notes, but I'll give it a go. Pia Jesu Domine, Dona eis Requiem, Requiem Aeternam, Dona eis Domine, Dona eis Domine. Then it would change keys. Pia Jesu Domine, Dona eis Requiem, Dona eis Requiem, Dona eis Domine. And this key change was always really difficult. Ad sempiternam
Requiem. Oh, so beautiful. Now, what about that opened your voice?
I guess there's a couple of things that are happening. Your breath is different. The way you place, the way you use your tongue is different. The tongue placement is different in your mouth. It's almost like even the way you use the muscles in your face, often to make those sounds, your jaw has to be slightly lowered and relaxed. And often, I don't know if you... When you watch me sing, you'll see that I sing often with a bit of a smile on. One, I'm enjoying myself. But two, when you smile, everything else is relaxed.
I want to play another song from your new album. And this is called The Good. Do you want to say something about what you were thinking about when you wrote it?
Yeah, so when I wrote it, we had gotten to a point where I knew that we needed an up-tempo song. We needed something with that felt upbeat and that felt fun. But I love writing ballads. I love writing love songs. I can't help it. It's sort of, I'm a mid-tempo
slow
song. That's what I do. And I enjoy them. I enjoy singing because of the space in them. But then, and so as we started writing, I thought, what can you make this about? And my friend, who is also the EP on this album with me, he said that he had been talking to a friend of ours about the relationship that she had had with her father. She said that the relationship wasn't great all the time, but they were starting to rebuild and that they were starting to have some really good moments. And then he passed away. And then she said, but she just wants to remember the good. And the light bulb went off, and I was like, that's the song. That's the song. The song is about remembering the good, even when something ends maybe not in the best of ways.
Well, let's hear the song. This is The Good from Cynthia Erivo's new album, Chapter 1, Verse 1.
Gone is the way we used to smile.
That's Cynthia Erivo from her new album, Chapter 1, verse 1. So this is kind of a personal question in terms of that it has personal meaning for me. So you're 5'1". Harriet Tubman, who you portrayed, was even shorter, and I'm not quite 5 feet. So as a short person, I'm wondering if you think it's had much of an impact on your life or your career to be short.
I don't know, because the thing is, a lot of people don't realize I am as short as I am.
I did not realize it. I was reading about you and I was like, really?
I mean, I spend a lot of my time in heels, but like often when I'm with other people, they're also like dressed up or in their heels. And so when I'm standing next to them, they're like, oh my goodness, you're really small. I think there have been times often that people assume that because you're small, you are weak. Or because you're small, sometimes people, they often decide that because you're small, you're also childlike, which sometimes is really strange because you have to sort of correct people and let them understand, well, actually, I'm a fully grown adult. I just happen to be small. So my understanding of what you are saying or anyone else is saying is just the same.
What about chairs? Do you find it's hard to find a chair that fits?
Yes, like chairs that are high enough to get to tables and stuff.
Well, chairs are like too deep and often too high.
So your legs are swinging off
the ground. Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's a thing. So you end up having to like perch to the edge of the seat so your feet can touch the ground. Or
podiums.
Podiums are hilarious because sometimes you're also like, you know what? Today I'm just going to swallow my pride and ask them for a little step so I can reach the podium and feel like I'm a normal height and reach this thing so I'm not having to tiptoe ever so slightly or wear, 15-inch heels. That is sort of like, it's that. You have to take the good with the bad with it, definitely. Stools, high chairs are really sometimes quite difficult because, you know, if you're singing and you want to sit, you're often on a stool, so you have to try and make sure that the stool is not too high for you to sit on. And so I always make the compromise with whatever dress I'm wearing or whatever clothes, because if they cover my feet, you can't see how far my feet are from the ground. Yeah.
And if the stool's too high, you have to kind of shimmy onto it.
Yeah.
Because you can't reach that high. Your behind doesn't reach that high.
It's like making little jumps to get there. It's like
and then slide down.
Oh my goodness.
Cynthia Erivo, it's been so delightful to talk with you. Thank you so much for doing this. And just thank you for your work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. You are wonderful. So thank you.
Cynthia Erivo's new album is called Chapter 1, Verse 1. Her new children's book is called Remember to Dream, Eberé. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. We had additional engineering today from Diana Martinez. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.